Okay, welcome to the fourth day of our sitting here in Montgomery. Judges Brasher and Wilson and I are pleased to have you here. If I may, just very briefly, I'm going to take the presider's privilege just to acknowledge the passing of a mentor of mine. Justice Souter died last night. I clerked for Justice Souter in 2000-2001, and he was just a remarkable individual. In every way. I've never been the smartest person in any room, but I'm pretty sure he was always the smartest person in every room. He was, as you know, fiercely independent. And I hope that's something that I've learned from him. Just a great American and a great man. And I hope that you can find people in your life who had the impact on you that he had on me. Thank you for that. So we've got three cases this morning. Rules of the road before we get going. Please know that we have read your stuff, so to speak. We've read your briefs and your cases and your statutes and your record material. And so you don't need to give us a statement of the case when you stand up. We know it. We know what the case is about. Just tell us why you think you ought to win. We'll start asking you questions, I'm sure. And then the traffic light system, you'll understand intuitively. Green is go, yellow is slow, red is stop. I historically have not been great about cutting people off in the middle of a sentence, and I probably won't do that to you either, but I would just ask you to respect the court's time. When you see the red light go on, know that it's time to wind up. All right, with that, let's get to the first case, 24-10147 Nelson versus Experian. We've got the Seals here for the appellant, Mr. Johnson here for the appellee, correct? Mr. Seals and Mr. Johnson. Okay, Mr. Seals, you've reserved 4 minutes, correct?
That is correct, sir.
Very well. Fire away whenever you're ready.
Yes, sir. Appreciating that y'all have read everything, I'll dive right in. We believe that the district court correctly held that the plain language of the statute imposed a duty on Experian to conduct investigations of Ms. Nelson's disputed data, and Experian has not challenged that holding or finding. However, the district court said, but there were some statutes, regulations that Experian could have reasonably relied on. Our position is the but and everything after that is error, that the analysis should have ended with the plain language of the statute imposes a duty. However, spelling out the roadmap, suffice it to say, assuming that the position being we don't have to investigate because PII or personal information is not part of a credit report, that's belied by the testimony of their own corporate representative who said regularly this information is included in credit reports and was included in the credit report provided to Ms. Nelson.
I guess I have a couple of questions.
Yes, sir.
So one, you're not suggesting, I assume, when you say, look, we think this sort of begins and ends with the plain language, that this is a strict liability statute, right? I mean, like it provides causes of action for negligent breaches and willful breaches, right?
That's correct, sir. It is not a strict liability statute like the FDCPA. My point is to say that the file doesn't include PII ignores the plain language of the statute, because as the CFPB in their amicus brief and the court in its order pointed out, there are sections that plainly tell Experian address goes in file, social security number is in file, name is in file.
So I think I on balls and strikes, I think I tend to agree with you that you probably have the better reading of the language, although I'm not sure that it's airtight, like sufficiently airtight to beat back certainly a willfulness and maybe even a negligence to justify either a willfulness cause of action or a negligence cause of action. You know, I mean, they would say probably giving you a steel manning your argument, they might say, yeah, so he's got probably like three bits of text that seem to favor him. We think we've got one or two that seem to favor us, but we've got these cases that the Seventh and the Ninth Circuits that favor us, and we've got some agency guidance. And given that whole ball of wax, you know, at the very least, you can't say that our reading was unreasonable.
But the problem with that is this: if the reading is this isn't included in the credit report and wouldn't be, and that's where we live and die, how do you reconcile it with the corporate representative's testimony that this is included in credit report?
Well, but I guess, I mean, isn't reasonableness and at least the version of willfulness that we have here, both of those are objective standards, right? So you can't say, well, you knew, and therefore, I mean, aren't we asking whether sort of the hypothetical reasonable person would have construed the statute this way?
I think that that's probably correct. But the problem is, if you look at the Collins case, if you look at Ricketson, if you look at Nunnally on this side, and then you look at the one Seventh Circuit case, I understand they talk about Telford, but as the court said, and as we've said, that is after the fact to a certain extent. And then you look at the regulations that don't apply to them. If we're doing the hypothetical scales of justice here, I think that it weighs with the plain language in our favor. But our point is that I don't know that we even get there due to the plain language. However, if we do, Your Honor, then how do you look at cases like Collins, like Nunnally, that say exactly what a file is, that Experian was a party to, not Nunnally, but they were party to Ricketson, they were party to Collins, and this very court told them, file does not, a consumer credit report cannot be conflated with a file. And the statute says if my client disputes information in her file, they're required to investigate. That is their duty. They breached that duty. And so I would say that that actually does uphold at least a negligence claim. Right. But
what do we do with the Supreme Court's opinion, though, in Safeco versus Burr? We have to disregard the rule that was established there, where the Supreme Court said that violation is not willful if a defendant followed an interpretation that could reasonably found in the courts. And this other interpretation was found in other courts, the Seventh and the Ninth Circuit.
I wouldn't say disregard the Safeco standard at all or the Safeco opinion. What I would say is we're looking at apples and oranges. The case they rely on, Gillespie, in the Seventh Circuit, deals with 1681G, which basically says this is what we have to disclose. It's upstream of 1681I. It also says we have to disclose the contents of a file, and they narrowed the description of the file in that Gillespie case. But again, respectfully, we're talking apples and oranges. The information that was disputed in Gillespie, a purge date, never appears in a credit report. Your name and address does.
So tell me if this is a goofy analogy, but this feels a little bit to me like qualified immunity. This may not be your area, but qualified immunity or the determinations that we make in habeas cases, where in both cases you say effectively when reviewing some other court's decision, or in the case of QI, an officer's decision, okay, there's one question whether it was wrong. Well, sort of balls and strikes, was it wrong? Then there's another question you have to ask, like, was it really wrong? And it seems like here, certainly to get to willfulness and even to get to negligence, you've got to show that it was, like, pretty wrong, right? And so I think you've got to convince us more than there's, like, a sort of a 51% chance that you have the better reading of the statute. I'm not going to assign negligence to it, but you've got to show that it's, like, pretty wrong. It's outside the realm of reasonable disagreement, right? Sure. And that's what negligence is.
Sure.
The failure to exercise reasonable care.
No, I don't disagree with that. And as far as qualified immunity, admittedly, that's not an area I practice in.
I'm not trying to kind of spring that on you. It just feels to me like the kind of thing in which there are sort of like successive determinations, one of which is who has the better reading of the statute.
Sure.
Frankly, I kind of think you do. But, sorry, and I know this is how the district court did it, but and you don't like the but. But I'm not sure that a contrary reading is unreasonable.
Well, I would point to this as well. Let's look at the players in this game. This statute governs Experian. This is their statute. If there's any entity on the planet that knows or should know the statute backwards and forwards, it's Experian. They include this information credit reports they provide to consumers and third parties. And to the consumer say, if you want to dispute anything, here are the instructions. Then they come back when you do that and say, well, wait a minute, we're not going to investigate that because we don't have to, based on one Seventh Circuit case and some regulations that don't apply to us, versus here are names in the statute, here are addresses in the statute, here are social security numbers in the statute. It gets to the point where respectfully, this appears to be obvious. It is something that you would be able to question, to be able to argue, because as I've said in my brief too, If we go to the logical conclusion here and they're allowed to not investigate these things, the furnishers certainly don't have to. So the consumer has absolutely zero recourse for remedial statute on five social security numbers. In this case, it was two. I mean, where do we draw the line? We're talking about yeah, I'm going over the speed limit, but only 1 mile an hour versus 100 miles an hour.
Can you explain something just as a matter of practice
yes,
to me? What is the harm to the consumer of having this error in the Social Security number associated sure. with? What are we trying to fix here?
What we're trying to fix is the statute says specifically consumer has a right to have a maximally accurate credit report,
mm-hmm.
right? If we have a number of names, et cetera, addresses, to go with a hypothetical, let's say one of the addresses is an ex-spouse, or you were a victim of identity theft at some point, and that address is still showing up, or that name or Social Security number. You say, please take that off of here. If we follow this, then Experian can say, we're not going to do that. Contact the furnisher. And then you're at the mercy of the furnisher to take it off. You have no recourse.
I guess I'm not sure that really answers my question, because I guess my point is, I understand if there's the wrong Social Security number and that leads to having incorrect loan information or something on
sure.
credit. I get that. But without the sort of incorrect loan information, or something that is a problem because of the Social Security number, does the wrong Social Security number do anything to the consumer at all?
Well, I would say this. If you're a credit grantor and you're looking at a person's credit report, deciding, will I loan this person money or extend credit? And there's hypothetically 7 Social Security numbers, 4 different names. That I think it's reasonable to say you may question that or wonder what's going on.
Okay. Next question I like. So you started by saying the Social Security number is part of the consumer report.
Right?
And so the Seventh Circuit said, look, it's reasonable at least to think that it means that the term file means information included in the consumer report. Could you just play that out? Because that I think is something that I may have missed. So in what way is the Social Security number in the consumer report? It seems like you're suggesting that even if we were to adopt the Seventh Circuit's rule, we should still rule in your favor. And I just want you to be able to play that out.
No, I understand. Let me be very clear, if I may. Names, addresses, for the testimony, at least 3 names, at least 3 addresses are provided to potential creditors or people marketing when they request them. Social Security numbers are not handed out. And if I gave that impression, I apologize.
Okay.
But the point still remains, this is plainly inaccurate and wrong information. And if we follow this, and there's absolutely no way to correct this, other than hoping that a furnisher, if they'll listen to you, will do that. And given the basis or the purpose of the statute, it seems unreasonable to say that this baseline bedrock information, your name, your address, your Social Security number, is off limits for them to have to investigate and report when they store it. And the file is all the information stored on this consumer. And then they regurgitate it to creditors. If you have absolutely no way to change this, what are we doing? At this point, we can parse out the statute and simply find retroactively ways to disregard other duties under the statute. And that's the concern in this case, or at least what provides the impetus for this appeal. And I see that I am out of time.
Okay, very well. Thank you. You've got 4 minutes of rebuttal time coming to you. Mr. Johnson?
Judge Newsman, may it please the court. The only question the court needs to answer today is whether Experian's interpretation of the act is objectively reasonable or is objectively unreasonable. Excuse me. It is not. 2 circuit courts have adopted that interpretation, which also follows decades of agency guidance and industry practice. And it has a foundation in the statute's text, which makes clear that Nelson's contrary interpretation, which I believe this morning we heard again, means all. Everything in the file is in the file, cannot be correct. So again, to go first to your question, Judge Newsom, about you now did this to qualified immunity. I think that's exactly right. I think that the Supreme Court's decision in Safeco, I believe by Justice Souter, explained with the citation to qualified immunity, actually, in saying what counts as objectively reasonable. And it's not my practice area either, but I would be shocked if someone was found liable under qualified immunity if 2 circuit courts had addressed the very question about whether this word in the statute, file, means what they say it means, and said no, it means what experience.
Just to dive into that, those circuit courts, though, aren't addressing something like a Social Security number. They were addressing like really ancillary stuff. Like if you look at the actual facts of those cases, they're not addressing something like that's basically the identifying information of the consumer. And I guess, could you just address that distinction? It just seems, they obviously support your position in like sort of the grand scheme of things. But I mean, I haven't found any court that said that someone's social security number is not part of the file.
Yeah, so a few things there. One, you're right in the grand scheme of things, which is the rule of interpretation that they adopted to explain the statute.
Well, I don't know. I mean, like if we follow the qualified, which I don't think, you know, sort of belabor this thing that everybody's saying we don't practice it. But, but you know, like there's sort of on point precedent that you can point to and say, look, a court said this specific thing is we have to do it or we don't have to do it. And then there's just kind of, well, a court said something similar. So those courts have said not everything is part of the file. Okay. You've got a court saying not everything is part of the file, but it's hard to imagine a court, certainly a circuit court, saying, oh, the personal identification number for the consumer that literally identifies the consumer and who the report is going to be about is not part of the file. And I guess that's like, isn't there some common sense here where we would say, yeah, okay, you've got, not everything is part of the file. So if they're trying to fight about something silly, okay, they can't do that. But like, isn't there a distinction between the personal identifying information and the stuff that was in those cases? I guess that's my point.
So I think two things on that. One, so take, for instance, the purge date. The purge date, when that's going to drop off your report, seems much more important to me, to the average consumer, and to the average credit-granting institution than whether or not Ms. Nelson's maiden name was spelled with two R's or one R.
Well, it does maybe, but so the, and now this is the last question I'll ask about this. I mean, the text says, the term file, when used in connection with information on any consumer, means all of the information on that consumer recorded and retained by the consumer reporting agency. I guess purge dates, stuff like that, I could see you saying, oh, that's not part of the information on that consumer, but their name, their address, their social security number. How can you read that language and say that's not part of the information on that consumer? It's like it's as on that consumer as it could possibly be. It's the individual identifying information on that consumer.
So I think the on the consumer part, it doesn't seem obvious to me that a purge date is not on the consumer. Everything is okay, in the file.
I guess because isn't a purge date just something that would just be for like everybody is the same?
It's specifically about your account and when your account will fall off of your credit report. We don't keep sort of generalized files that just talk about things generally. We keep consumer files that have information about a consumer. So I don't think that the on the consumer can do the work. On the point of whether, you know, this is just so obvious, I guess that's where I really do retreat to. The statute's been read this way for decades now. The agency has given guidance on this for decades now. The system that the agency...
Had the agency ever said that you don't have to investigate Social Security number errors?
It has said it's not part of the file.
What did it say that the Social Security number of the consumer is not part of the file?
It said personal identifying information is not
in
the file.
Give me a citation to that.
It's in the 2011... guidance and in the 1990 guidance, I believe. Let me get the exact.
But both of those, I think, say maybe not quite what you said, but they say instead that file constitutes the information that the agency would likely be, to be furnished or would likely to furnish to a third party. Correct.
I believe that's right, and I apologize. On the FTC 2011 report, on the first page, there's a discussion about whether PII is part of a credit report. The Gray decision in the district courts also explains why that's not part of it. That leads me into a response to my...
So I'm sorry. So just to be clear, that guidance is about what goes on the credit report and not what is part of the file.
No, I believe...
It says the file is the stuff that would be disclosed to third parties.
Yes.
Okay. And your point, I guess my extrapolation is not quite there in black and white, but my extrapolation is... maiden names and social security numbers are not the sorts of things that would be disclosed to third parties.
Exactly. And on that point,
would a name not be disclosed to the third party?
It's disclosed in the sense that you're told that. But here's what we said about this in the district court, and here's what they responded with. Statement of undisputed material fact number 5. PII is used, quote, merely to identify a consumer and match that consumer with the accounts he or she owns. It is not used to assess eligibility for credit, employment, or insurance. That was admitted. It was undisputed in this case below that the material we're talking about is not part of a credit report. It was just, if Experian just mailed a letter to you that said your name, your address, that would not be a credit report. That was undisputed below. It was only on appeal that they've now come to challenge this information. So I think that argument is forfeited. And it's not just an ordinary case. It's deeply unfair for us to litigate a case on the premise that this is what we're talking about and then have it be unscrambled on appeal. And then I guess to go again to this point of sort of how much we were warned off, what we should have known, it may be that Gillespie and Tailford come from a slightly different context. It may be that the agency's guidance did not, you know, in hic verba say PII, including social security numbers and so forth in this stuff. It may not be that the furniture regulation that says furniture, don't worry about this at all, doesn't directly apply to this. At some point you get to the Safeco analysis and you say, really? It was objectively unreasonable for Experian to continue doing what it and every other credit reporting agency have been doing for decades, openly and notoriously. I mean, the agencies have known exactly how we process these disputes for many years. And until their amicus brief in this court, they never once raised their hand to say, actually, you should be figuring out whether or not her name really had two R's in it. And I think that leads to another argument that I think is important to put on the table today, which is it's very unclear in what sense we were supposed to have inaccurately reported these pieces of information. We said on the disclosure, the following information is reported to us by you, your creditors, and or other sources. Each source may report your personal information differently, which may result in variations of your name, address, social security number, et cetera. We were not telling the world Ms. Nelson's proper address is this one. We were not telling the world Ms. Nelson's proper social security number is this one. And that dovetails into two separate points. One, Judge Brasher, you asked, what is the harm here? If this were a case of a mismatched account where because of this information, no, that's not my account. That's not my address. That would be a separate thing you could challenge under the FCRA. The idea that opposing counsel raised seemed to be, well, the statute gave me a right to have a maximally accurate credit file. And it could not be clearer from TransUnion and other cases, Spokio, but that itself. With apologies, Judge Newsom, I know it's a sore spot.
Well, that's a question. I mean, honestly, that's a question I have, is that this is sort of a, I could understand the harm, even if it's more of a theoretical harm, of there's a file that's on my credit report that's not mine. You know, you're reporting some account that you say is mine, but it's somebody else's, and you did that because there's a social security mishap. You know, what I do question whether they're standing here, given that there's been no mishap. It's just literally we found this error.
The district court found standing from the sort of act of having to keep disputing, the writing the letters. In some circuits, that would not fly. In this circuit, I think it probably does. And so we haven't challenged standing on appeal. I will leave that for the two of you.
Well, answer this, though. And this kind of goes to the same kind of thing with my earlier question. So let's say that this Social Security number did end up with a wrong account, right? So it's got, you know, it's got a social security number that's off by one, and it turns out that person who has that social security number is like a real deadbeat and has all these accounts they didn't pay back. And so, you know, the plaintiff has a bad credit score now and all this kind of stuff and is trying to unravel that. Wouldn't Experian have to change the social security number that they're attaching to that to fix that? It seems odd to say, oh, we would just go through and we would investigate like those accounts that are wrong, but we would never change the social security number that led to those wrong accounts.
So I'm not sure I'm understanding hypothetical.
So the social security number is the wrong social security number. And so now there's all these accounts that are wrong on the credit report, right?
But they're also on the report.
Yeah, they're on the report.
The wrong accounts.
Yeah. Okay. And so, and the plaintiff says, fix those accounts. And I think you would agree you'd have to fix those accounts. That's something you'd have to investigate.
100%.
Okay. What would you do? Wouldn't you fix the social security number?
We would delete the wrong accounts.
Yeah, but you would leave the social security number that led to the wrong accounts?
I think we would do precisely what we did here for that part of it. We would say, look, the problem that was caused by this mismatched account has been solved. We have removed the wrong accounts. You think that comes because you got a social security number wrong. We have never been and do not think ourselves capable of being in the whose social security number is the correct social security number. Please contact the furnisher. They're more than happy to have it adjusted. And of course, if this happens again, you know, we can get that fixed. The idea that they're without a remedy, I think is
sort of, but doesn't the FTC say that a furnisher doesn't have to do that?
So a furnisher doesn't have a legal obligation to update the account under the direct furnisher obligations. I'm not aware of any credit card company, loan servicing that won't say, well, yeah, of course we want our account to match it. You can often adjust these things yourself in their online account system. So this idea that there's going to be this sort of flagrant and profligate misuse of personal identification, I think is just wrong. Secondly, I think the furniture regulation is really cut in favor of us.
Right.
It is very strange to think that we are under an obligation to resolve a dispute that furnishers themselves, by regulation, are not required to dispute when they're the ones that passed along the wrong information in the first place. And I get that it's not the same regulation. I get it doesn't cover us directly. But in a qualified immunity-style, Safeco reasonableness world, of course, that's one of the factors that has to weigh into the analysis. How could you consult?
Well, isn't maybe the idea that the furnishers don't have to do it because you have to do it? I'm not saying that's the most reasonable.
That approaches the minimum rationality requirement of the due process clause in terms of, does that make any sense at all? I suppose that's the account of Congress and the agency's intent that my friend on this one has to adopt. I find it difficult. And more importantly, again, the question for this court is not if we're just sitting down looking at the statute as it's been cobbled together over decades, who has the better of it? The question of it is, are we objectively unreasonable such that we're liable in tort for that situation? I think the answer to that question is obviously no. And for that reason, I think I just also want to...
You also have to establish, though, don't you, under the Safeco conditions that there's a foundation in the statutory text to support your interpretation of the statute. And so I guess my concern is I'm looking at the statutory text and it uses the term any item of information contained in a consumer's file. And if it doesn't include personally identifiable information, what do they mean by any?
Sure. So 2 points, Your Honor. First, I actually don't agree that under Safeco you have to run the table on each issue. Imagine that 5 circuit courts had, read all means all to not include this, and you just conclude there's no basis at all for that. Under Safeco, I still think defendants are allowed to say, look, courts find interesting interpretations of statute all the time. We're allowed to rely on what courts do. It's not objectively unreasonable, and it certainly isn't willful for us to follow what the 9th Circuit and the 7th Circuit have said, even if they're totally wrong about the text. As far as the text, I think it oversimplifies things to state that sort of any means any, how do you get out of that? Section 1681GA1, a neighboring provision with a similar purpose, had any means any up there, and then proceeds to lay out 5 different categories of information that would never fit, that would obviously fit up there. It would be totally superfluous. So we know that there has to be a line somewhere. And the question is where, Your Honor, I see this.
You can finish my sentence.
I think the place that we've drawn the line, that the 7th Circuit and the 9th Circuit drew the line, and that the agency for decades draw the line, makes sense. It shows this is the reason we have this statute, and what it's about is helping people get accurate credit information in their credit reports. If the material will not be included within and used for the basis of credit reporting decisions, it doesn't have to fall within the statute. It doesn't have to be disclosed. But again, all that matters is whether it's objectively unreasonable. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very good. Thank you so much. Mr. Steeles, you got 4 minutes remaining.
Yes, sir. With regard to all doesn't mean all, sure, Reed Gillespie, but all does mean personal information. All does mean any information does mean personal information. If we're going to stare at Gillespie, that's fine. We can look and take it to extremes. I think they cite Telford for saying whether a person prefers cats over dogs, et cetera. But this is personal identification information. And as far as it not showing up in a credit report, again, and I'm beating this dead horse, their own representative, the evidence in this case is this information, at least the names and addresses, shows up in credit reports. So that undermines this argument that, well, we don't have to investigate because it doesn't show up in credit reports.
I think maybe to give to sort of the Steelman his argument, like it doesn't show up in credit reports in a way that's meaningful to a credit decision, right?
Right.
Like, so it might, so as Judge Brasher says, it might sort of be there on the face of the credit report, but it's not a datum that impacts a credit making decision.
I think it's quite a leap to say that and assume that every credit grantor in this country absolutely ignores that there are multiple addresses, multiple names, et cetera. I don't think there's any evidence as to that fact. The evidence is disappears. And I take your point, Judge. I understand. However, again, it goes back to this is plainly incorrect. They have no duty, according to them, to challenge it. And then you have a class of consumers or group consumers, of which my client is one, that if they challenge it with the furnisher, per the regulations, the furnisher doesn't have to do anything. And to take Judge Brasher's hypothetical, let's say that bad Social Security number was with Discover Bank. You call Discover Bank and say, this needs to come off. Well, you're not our customer. We don't know who you are. Well, this is not my Social Security number. Okay. There's no recourse at that point if we follow what Experian wants us to follow, if we let this stand.
Can I ask you just a question sort of abstracting out a little bit? And again, I'm not trying to get into an area that you don't practice in,
yes. But
I'm just curious. So is the FCRA unique among statutes in this orbit generally in the sense that it's not a strict liability statute and that it imposes liability only for negligent and willful breaches?
No, I believe, and forgive me, but I believe RESPA is also similar. I know FDCA is strict liability. I want to say TILA, but I don't want to misspeak to the
point. I guess what I'm sort of driving at here is that there's some reason that Congress saw fit not to make this a strict liability regime.
Yes, sir.
Right?
Yes, sir. I think a lot of that goes into the statutory scheme, or the way it normally works is it turns on whether or how the investigation goes. Did they get enough information? Did they go to the source? Did the source do what it's supposed to do? That's different than, say, an FDCPA case where, I won't go into FDCPA, but I think that's kind of the basis of it is it really looks at what did they do in this circumstance in a way that's different in other circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Because they could have investigated and said, look, we called the whatever, and they said it is your Social Security number. And then the question we'd have is whether that was a reasonable investigation, right?
Absolutely. I would posit that if they had contacted the furnishers of this information, the furnisher said it's all correct, they've done their statutory duty. There's no case against them. But they didn't do that. What they did was send her a letter saying, contact us and we'll maybe tell you who they are, or words to that effect. And so my point in that is it frustrates a consumer trying to get a correct credit report, which is the entire purpose of the statute.
Can I ask you just a record question? So
yep.
You say that, you know, there's some stuff on the credit. Is the credit report in the record?
The credit, so there's a term of art, credit report and credit disclosure.
Okay. Right?
We have two credit disclosures contained in the record. However, there was no credit report obtained from some GMAC Finance didn't get one, and then we went and got it, so to speak.
So that, I mean, could you just tell me where that is in the record, the credit disclosure then?
The credit disclosure. Off the top of my head, I'm happy to provide it, though.
Yeah, would you mind? I mean, so if you can't, then would you just file like a sentence? Just
nope, not a problem at all. We'll have to, happy to do it. And I'll do both credit disclosures, the one in November and the one after we filed the suit that was pulled.
And does the record also reflect that the personally identifiable information is in the file?
With regard to those disclosures, absolutely. That's what triggered this entire case. My client pulled that, saw it, disputed, and the rest is history. So here we are. Your Honor, also further, I guess I would say, and I'm wrapping up on time here, what I would say specifically is this. I believe very, very strongly that Experian understands that this is part of a person's file. I believe very strongly that Experian understands that personal information in this day and age of identity theft, et cetera, is very important. I believe that they understand that the statute requires this. And the after the fact, retroactively finding law to try to justify the position seems, if we're talking about unfairness, seems unfair.
Okay.
That's what I have, Your Honor.
Got it. Okay, very well. Thank you both. Well argued on both sides. That case is submitted. We'll move to the second case of the day.